This is another iRaw podcast.
Because sentientism is neutral on all of that stuff. It just says whatever sentience is and wherever it is, it matters. It's the morally salient thing that we should be focusing on.
Welcome back to The Animal Turn, everyone. This is another bonus episode for you. This time I'm going to be doing a review of a podcast, which is known as Sentientism. And in fact, throughout the episode, we speak more about the idea of sentientism than the actual podcast. But I think through the conversation, you'll get a good sense of what you could expect if you listened to Sentientism as a podcast, as well as the usefulness of the concept in your own work, and perhaps, you know, what flaws and openings you think the concept might present. If you're interested in some of the work Jamie does, he's been on tons of different podcasts. Most recently, he was on Knowing Animals with Josh Milburn. Really interesting conversation there as well. These two, I promise you, I'm not copying everything Josh does. It just so happens that my last episode and this one are very similar to some of the work Josh is doing. I think we just happen to be interested in similar kinds of people and opportunities. But it's done in the spirit of collaboration, and I think Jamie has fascinating things to say, and I hope that you'll find this conversation useful. I've certainly learned a lot more about sentientism in this conversation with Jamie. And as you can hear throughout the episode, I have several reservations about the concept, but I find that having this conversation in and of itself a really useful mechanism for thinking about animals and what kind of work the different concepts we use does. So just to tell you a little bit about Jamie is working to develop sentientism as a worldview and as a global movement. He hosts the Sentientism podcast as well as a YouTube channel and has published several articles and presented at academic seminars. He talks about sentientism both as a philosophy as well as its implications. He's building a range of global sentientism communities, which is open to everyone, whether you agree with the concept or the idea, or you're simply interested in it, or you don't, but you want to learn more, you're welcome to go there. You'll find a whole range of people that are keen to converse with you and talk to you about the concept. Currently, it spans over 100 countries. You can find Jamie on Twitter at Jamie Woodhouse, and you can also find the podcast and his channels on Twitter with @sentientism. I'll include all of those links in the bio as well. So let me leave it there. Enjoy the conversation. Okay, hi, Jamie. Welcome to the Animal Tone podcast.
Hey, it's an honor to be here. Great to talk to you again.
It's really fun. I know we've already been giggling in the in the green room. It's really cool to have you on. As you know, this is part of a new kind of bit I'm trying on the Animal Tone, which is to see if I can squeeze in some reviews of different things in between the seasons. And I recently did a book review, and now I'm hoping to do some podcast reviews, because I think there are just awesome podcasts out there doing some work related to animals. And we've been chatting for a long time, actually, just back and forth in little bits and bobs, and your work is really interesting. So I'm really, really thrilled that you've carved out some time. And we're going to be speaking about your time in this episode, because I don't understand how you do as much as you do. Like I imagine that you're just sitting in a basement somewhere all by yourself with no friends and no family, and you're just doing sentientism work all the time, because you produce so much.
It's a little like that, yeah. Although the family behind me might beg to differ.
And it doesn't look like a dingy, you look like you're in a really nice space there. It doesn't look like my imagination at all.
No, we're pretty lucky. I'm not in a dungeon basement. But the family complain because we're quite open plan here. So they're forced to listen to at least my side of most of the conversations, which is probably not a good deal, but they have to put up with it.
Well, then they know all your arguments through and through. Okay, well, firstly, let's for folks who don't know you, so you know that I primarily speak to people within the animal studies realm or people that are interested in animals. And I thought speaking to you for the first podcast review would be quite interesting, because you sit at a fascinating intersection, I think, when it comes to thinking about animal studies. You kind of both open it up and close it down in interesting ways, and I'm hoping we'll talk about that later on in the episode. But before we get into that, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about yourself and the podcast, and what got you started in launching the podcast.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a strange background, because I had a sort of fairly standard corporate career before I started diving into a range of different projects that I'm working on now. And sentientism over time has just become the center of that, the thing I mm-hmm. concentrate most of my time on. But the path to getting to that was long and torturous, but it might help cue up some of the themes we're going to talk about in this sentientism idea. Because I guess I grew up with a fairly typical sort of English experience of non-human animals. We had companion animal in the house that we all loved unconditionally as a family member. I had experiences living in the countryside with various types of wild animals that I felt varying degrees of affinity with. But sadly, you know, part of the hobbies were also going out and killing some of them and through fishing and so on. And there were glimmers of, oh, this doesn't feel right there, but never anything that really cut through with me. And of course, I consumed animal products, you know, without even questioning the impact of what I was doing. So that was sort of fairly standard starting point. And the reason the path was torturous is because my thinking about non-human animals basically didn't really shift for a couple of decades from that point. But in the meantime, I was thinking through different aspects of ethics and epistemology too. So in that context, I grew up as a Church of England Christian. But again, this is pretty common in England. They didn't really mean a great deal. It wasn't much of a cultural force. It was just a sort of gentle backdrop thing that was around. Went to church a couple of times a year, maybe a few times more. I by default believed that stuff, but it never really had a strong impact on our lives. And in my teenage years, again, sort of classic transition, I started digging into that, learning more about it, understanding comparative religions, the social history of religions, and moved away from that religious worldview and became an atheist. Partly because of many of the ethical problems I saw popping up in different religious modes of thought around the world. But the core of it really was a sort of facts and evidence thing. Just didn't seem to be true. It seemed much more likely to be a human fabrication than something that was inspired by a deity. So I became atheist. But atheism, or at least an extreme agnostic, if you like. So that doesn't really say much about ethics or morality or, you know, how to do right and wrong in the world. So that led me on to exploring humanism, which in simple terms and its modern incarnation is a sort of secular naturalistic stance that says, you know, use a scientific way of understanding the world, evidence and reason to try and hopefully with humility understand reality. But it layers on top of that a universal human compassion, at least, and says, look, we don't need a deity or anything supernatural to be moral beings. The human in humanism means we can, as humans, have our own morality, and that can take mm-hmm. all sorts of different forms, but we can do that ourselves. And so I found humanism positive because it built on that sort of naturalistic, atheistic starting point, but laid on a universal compassion, at least for all humans. But I came to recognize, partly through my sister's vegetarianism and later veganism, that there was a problem in humanism, and again, the clue is in the name, in that it doesn't restrict our compassion to just our species, but it's very strongly anthropocentric. So it goes from this confidence in us humans as moral agents, being able to define our own morality without needing the supernatural. And that quite often for many humanists then becomes universal compassion for humans, and that's pretty much where it stops. Mm-hmm. So I found this frustration of that limited moral scope within humanism. I liked its naturalism. I liked its universal compassion, but that compassion didn't go far enough. And through, you know, having that sort of family nudge of my sister's vegetarianism and then veganism, and then myself going vegetarian and much later vegan, I was looking around for a worldview that fixed those problems because I wanted the naturalism. I wanted to keep that. But I also wanted a moral scope that extended out to all sentient beings, any being that has the capacity to suffer and flourish. And there didn't really seem to be anything out there. It seemed mm-hmm. as if there were, you know, plenty of different organizations and movements and philosophies that were focused on naturalism and atheism and skepticism and free thinking and rationalism or whatever you like. But they didn't, nearly all of those seemed to be very anthropocentric in their culture and style and their programs of work. And then separately, there seemed to be this a very rich vein of campaigning and philosophy and thinking and academia that was focused on the question of moral scope and pushing us as humans to extend our moral scope in various ways. And while much of that work sort of implied a naturalistic grounding, it seemed to be somewhat independent of the epistemology too. And I was like, shouldn't there really be something that combines mm. both of these things together? And that's what led me to picking up this term sentientism, which I didn't coin. It's been around since the 1970s.
So your background, you said you were primarily in in a corporate setting and you became interested just to synthesize. So you were primarily in a corporate background and you had all of these different pressures kind of in terms of thinking about religion, but also thinking about animals. And you found yourself increasingly frustrated by how these two realms were separated. There was a concern for humanism on the one hand, and others may be concerned with animals on the other hand, but these two worlds didn't seem to come together. And you thought sentientism would help to bring the conversation across this divide. Is that kind of in a... Yes. Maybe.
Yeah. And it's not just about bringing the conversation across the divide. I guess it was a sense that, you know, having a well-founded ethics by itself is great, but it's not sufficient. Just as having a really strong epistemology by itself is great, but it's not sufficient. I think.
And just to remind listeners, epistemology here is talking about like how we know what we know.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you like, you know, I may use the philosophical terms in a slightly fuzzy way, but there's an idea of ontology, which is, you know, what is reality and what is the stuff around us and what, you know, what exists. And there's this question of epistemology, which is, and how can we know about that stuff? And, you know, what are the best approaches to knowing and believing and having credences? And I think they're both deeply important if we want to have a worldview, you know, a way of engaging with the world that gives us a chance to make things better in the broader sense.
I think that's incredibly important. Like, how do we know what we know is and what we take for granted in that knowledge, what we take for granted, I think, is a fundamental question in terms of a lot of the work we do. Okay, so when about was this switch for you from, you know, corporate Jamie to podcast Jamie? Like when, and I know sentientism is much bigger. So maybe tell us just not yet about the kind of concept of sentientism, but about how you as Jamie, the person, moved from being in a corporate space, like what kind of corporate space were you in, and then becoming, how did sentientism, like what is that organization? What are the nuts and bolts of what I'm seeing when I go to your sentientism websites and stuff?
Yeah. So all the things I've been talking about have been interests that I'd really squeezed around the edges of my life because family, friends, and had a very intense corporate life that, you know, routinely involved 14 to 16 hour days and working weekends and all sorts of other things, which was intense and powerful and great people, and I got an enormous amount out of it. But all of these things I was talking about were really squeezed around the edges. So the simple terms about the transition was that I left that world really so that I could bring all these things into the center and concentrate on them. So since then I've been working on a portfolio of different projects that sometimes involve NGO and charitable work, involve open data project, and there's a portfolio of different things. But over time, this sentientism idea has been taking up more and more of a central role in that portfolio of projects I'm working on. So to answer your question as to, you know, what is it? In a sense, it's just a worldview. So it's a way of thinking. So it's quite abstract. But what I've been trying to do around that is, you know, the ultimate aim is to persuade 7.9 billion humans to agree with me and thereby solving all the world's problems.
All the world's problems.
We're on dangerous ground already. I am sort of joking, but at the same time, not entirely. But the things I've been doing really are, one, developing content around the idea. So that involves working on those sort of philosophical underpinnings and making sure that they're robust and reasonably solid, thinking through the implications that we might have of a sentientist worldview in terms of individuals, institutions, policies, you know, all sorts of different levers of change we might pull if we were moving towards a more sentientist world. So that's content. So that's the podcast and YouTube and some writing I've done. The second is outreach, which has been really, you know, talking to people like you in different fields, philosophers, people in animal studies, people in AI ethics, people in working in fields of epistemology, people working in policy, advocates, to engage with them, to get them to sort of pressure test the sentientism idea, but also hopefully to influence them and suggest it might be a platform that we could share and use together. And obviously many of those people end up, you know, I'm lucky enough to have them as guests on the podcast and the YouTube. And then the third thing is building communities. So these are partly because of the influence of COVID all online so far. But that's mm-hmm. online communities based around social media platforms, so Facebook, Telegram, Signal, Discord, and so on, where people can come together, whether or not they agree with the ideas of sentientism, to just engage with the ideas and think about the implications. So those are the three things I guess you'd say are parts of what sentientism at the moment. But it's quite amorphous, it's quite anarchic, and it's very amateurish. So at the moment, there's no formal organization. There's no governance, there's no money, there's no, you know, it's just a worldview, but with these communities and content built up around it.
What's all around you, almost everywhere you look, and makes your life better? Birds. Learn all about these beautiful creatures in this wonderful new podcast called Birds of a Feather Talk Together. Two experts guide two newbies on their journey to learn more. Mallard ducks, ivory-billed woodpeckers, Hawaiian honeycreepers, blue jays, cardinals, sandhill cranes, and more. Each week we discuss a different bird and walk away with a better understanding of the birds all around us. Oh, and we have a ton of fun doing it. Listen now. You're going to like learning about these birds. I guarantee it.
Well, I mean, you do a lot of work, and I think you don't give yourself enough credit for just how much, because I'm guessing 90% of what's going on behind that website is, you know, there is organization. You're doing a lot of work. I know obviously firsthand that it takes work to get guests. It takes work to edit and put things up in a show, and just the massive amounts of content that you've acquired. So when did you launch the website for Sentientism?
So the whole thing's been going for probably 4 or 5 years now, but I think the website was probably launched maybe 3 years ago. The podcast's been going for maybe 18 months, something like that.
So we started our podcast at kind of the same time, almost like within a couple of months of one another. And I think just to give listeners a sense, so I'm maybe like 50 episodes in, kind of, and you're at what, like 127?
128.
and that's not even to mention the guest appearances you make on other shows. So I know you were recently on Knowing Animals. You've been on Our Hen House. So I'm sure a lot of folks who are listening here have heard you speak in many of these places about sentientism. And I'm hoping that we can just highlight some of the cool work you're doing. So on the podcast itself, you've spoken to 128 people. And in general, what have you found people's maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me give you an opportunity. So we started speaking a bit about sentientism as a concept. And maybe in a bit we can kind of talk a little bit about how people have responded to this concept on your show and what you've found to be some of the main areas where people are excited about the concept, as well as some of the main concerns related to the concept. But before we get to that, let's hear from you. What is sentientism? When we are talking about sentientism, what is it exactly that we're talking about here?
So I describe it in a sentence as a commitment to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. So to put a little bit more flesh on the bones, it's trying to answer what I think of as the two deepest and most important philosophical questions. So the first one is, what is real and how should we go about understanding reality? So sentientism suggests we should take a naturalistic approach, which in common sense terms is using evidence and reason with humility to try to understand what's real. So you might set that against maybe a supernatural way of thinking or a fideistic faith-based way of thinking or a dogmatic way of thinking that is somewhat arbitrarily committed to a belief. It says, look, we only have limited perception and limited ability to reason. Let's not kid ourselves, but let's at least honestly try to engage with reality and base our credences, our beliefs on experiences of that reality and evidence broadly defined and hopefully good quality reasoning about it. So that's the naturalistic part of sentientism. And then the other side is one about ethical scope, which is suggesting that we should grant moral consideration or have compassion for every being that is sentient. So, a good definition of that really is the capacity to have valenced experiences. And to me, that makes sense because whatever type of school of ethical thinking we're engaged in, I think the center of ethics has to be about whether and how we have a concern for others. And that concern for others, to me, means that we value the way they value their own existence and their own experiences. So to qualify, all they need is to have some sort of valuing of their own experience, and then we agree to value that too. And to me, that almost definitionally is the center of an ethical stance. And another practical way of putting it the other way around is, you know, why should there be any suffering or flourishing that we would exclude from our moral consideration, whatever ethical system we use? So that's why I come back to this combination of a naturalistic, methodologically naturalistic commitment to using evidence and reason, and then a sentiocentric commitment to moral consideration for all sentient beings. But that's it. And I try and keep it as a very pluralistic, simplistic baseline.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't go as far as saying this is simplistic. I mean, you're speaking about really, I think, profound ideas here that are quite controversial for in some areas. You know, who is considered sentient and not is not something that is accepted by everyone, right? And people are constantly trying to draw and redraw these lines of who should be considered sentient or not. And we're constantly finding those lines being redrawn, some beings being considered. And this, I've got to admit, is where my one concern comes in, is it does feel like just another boundary drawing activity where do we run the risk of, you know, you speak about reason and science. And we spoke about this when I was on your show a little bit, when, you know, reason and science are often used to justify particular positions and points of view, and they draw lines almost all the time. They draw lines of inclusion and exclusion. And I think we necessarily do draw lines of inclusion and exclusion. I think whenever we're talking about anything, who we're including in that consideration also necessitates a particular type of exclusion in the same move, if that makes sense. So even in your move of saying we're considering sentience or sentient beings in this ethical consideration, it means that you are also drawing a line of exclusion. So what would that line of exclusion entail?
So, and this comes through in many of the conversations, because some of the challenges to sentientism aren't actually a challenge to sentientism. There may be a challenge to a particular version of it or a particular implication of it. And that's partly why this idea of sentientism is deliberately very pluralistic and basic, and is therefore neutral on quite a lot of important questions. It doesn't aim to resolve them. In a way, it's suggesting that sentience should be the only thing you require to be morally considered. Yeah, so it's neutral on lots of really important topics, which can irritate people. So firstly, I'd say that it's focusing on making sure that we include every sentient being in our moral consideration. But I think it can be quite open-minded about whether we want to go beyond that. So there are some people who say, look, I am a sentientist. I grant moral consideration to all sentient beings. But there are also some types of beings that I don't think are sentient, or maybe even some types of concepts that don't relate to sentience that also have meaning to me. And I'm very open-minded to that. My concern is much more about the exclusion of sentient beings than it is about including beings or entities that aren't sentient. So that's one thing I'd say. I think it's like at least grant moral consideration to the sentient beings and go further if you like. There are some risks there, and I think you can see those play through with people who often have a biocentric or an ecocentric worldview, because as soon as you start to grant moral consideration to entities that are not sentient, there is a risk that then undermines the stance in your ethical considerations of beings that actually can suffer. And that makes me very nervous. So you can see in some, ecocentric stances, it leads people to be quite quick to, for example, cull wild animals in defense of a habitat or some ecocentric concept. And that's something I'd want to challenge and have a much more sentiocentric view on. But having said that, I think there is openness to going further to manage that risk that we're excluding entities that, maybe there's danger in excluding. But the neutrality, I think, is important as well, because sentientism doesn't tell us which species are sentient. It doesn't have a list. It just says follow a naturalistic approach and be prudent and humble about trying to work out, you know, probabilistically and provisionally which entities might be sentient. So it doesn't specify that list. It doesn't insist on a particular philosophy of mind. So there are panpsychist sentientists, and there are you know, sort of more materialist, physicalist sentientists like me, and lots of people who have different views about what sentience is. And sentientism says, well, whatever you like, as long as you're using a naturalistic approach to try and work it out, in a sense, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And it also doesn't specify whether sentience itself is something that is binary or sharp-edged or fuzzy-edged or graded or multidimensional. And it also doesn't insist ethically whether we take a perfectly egalitarian stance across every sentient being, or whether mm-hmm. we recognize that, you know, if we consider an ant or a human and we say, well, we think they're both sentient, would it still make sense under some circumstances to grant differential moral consideration? On one hand, that's really irritating because sentientism is neutral on all of that stuff. It just says whatever sentience is and wherever it is, it matters. It's the morally salient thing that we should be focusing mm-hmm. on. It does also insist on quite a clear baseline implication for what we mean by compassion and moral consideration. And where I try and draw that line is to suggest that, you know, if a being is sentient, we should at least not needlessly cause it harm or kill it. To my mind, that's the minimum that compassion or moral consideration should mean. If you're willing to needlessly harm or kill an entity, to my mind, that implies you have zero compassion for it or zero moral consideration. So it's also trying to include that quite practical baseline. So even though it's quite neutral and quite open, it does say that when an entity is sentient, there are some very clear implications for our moral and ethical treatment of that being.
You know, I mean, I think what might make this also a bit easier is to think about some other isms, right? So like you think about feminism or Marxism or any ism where people have abided by or think through a particular both way of thinking and ethical stance, I think. So epistemology as well as ethical orientation. You look at feminism, a lot of people tend to think, for example, that all feminists are the same and we all have the same orientation. And we all have the same ideas of how we're going to get to a place in which different genders are respected, in effect. But there are a variety of different types of feminists working in and through these ideas in a variety of ways. Yeah. But we all are united in that we view the project, I guess, of thinking through gender relations as important and central. And I think in many ways what sentientism is here is doing is doing that, but with a different kind of subject in mind to some extent. So instead of putting gender or gendering, you're perhaps putting sentience, right? Not necessarily species, but sentience, because this obviously can stretch across AI as well as, you know, animals and a variety of things at the forefront of your questioning. And to some extent, I actually think that you're a bit more radical than your neutral stance. I mean, I've seen you on Twitter and stuff. There's definitely more of a radical orientation in this. And I think a more radical call to thinking through, you know, you say it's a practical suggestion to not kill or not hurt. I think it's a radical suggestion when you consider the ubiquity with which others, both animal and human, are killed and hurt with abandon. So I think that it's actually a really radical standpoint because this is done without thinking and without thought, which means that you are in this very act undermining taken for granted assumptions. And I think that there's nothing, I would say there's nothing neutral about that because you are nudging and knocking at the door of people's taken for granted views.
And I think you're right, but that's the interesting juxtaposition for me, because while it's neutral on lots of important points, that doesn't mean it's not saying anything. And I think it is deeply radical. I think it is deeply radical because it takes and reiterates all of those things that you might find in a sort of modern feminist, anti-racist, anti-homophobic sort of human ethic that is progressive and recognizes universal human value. And it says, yes, the reason we should grant universal and equal human value to all humans is because they're all sentient beings. And now let's extend that. And so on the one hand, it picks up that somewhat radical stance within intra-human ethics, but then it makes it even more radical by saying, and now we need to consider seriously the sentience of non-humans too. So I think it can be neutral and pluralistic, but still deeply radical. And one of the other interesting things about it is that If you have a conversation with anyone on the street and you say, look, let's talk about the things you believe and how you choose to believe. Are your beliefs based on evidence and reasoning? And do you think that's the best way of believing? Nearly everyone will say yes. You know, what else could there be? But then, of course, you go into a series of conversations about, well, how about in this space? How about in that space? How about in that space? What is the evidence that underpins that? And of course, you know, for most people, that will fall apart somewhere. And most people around the world, that will fall apart in many spaces, because we know people deeply believe things that are completely unfounded in many different realms. And that has an impact within the human sphere. But I'd argue that epistemological failure is also a critical part of the animal problem too, in that the statement, the belief, for example, animal farming is humane, is not a failure of compassion. That's a failure of epistemology. You just believe something that is not supported by the evidence. So on the one hand, people will say, yes, of course, we should use evidence and reason to ground our beliefs. But in practice, there are many domains where people just do not put that into practice because of social norms and indoctrination. So people will agree, but then don't carry it through. And I think it's similar on the sentiocentric side too, because if you say, well, does the suffering of non-humans matter? And you ask most people on the street, they will say, of course it does. But then again, you can have a conversation and say, well, what does it mean to have compassion? You know, what's the minimum that showing compassion would mean? And are our lives consistent with that? And then again, things fall apart. So on the one hand, this evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings is somewhat unremarkable. Almost everybody will probably agree with it. But then when you start to talk about the implications, which I think are deeply radical, then that's where the pushback happens and that's where the challenge happens. And those challenges are much more, I think, to do with human psychology, social norms, and patterns of indoctrination than they are actually philosophical arguments or technical problems.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. Like, I think I know you place your pressure on thinking through kind of how evidence and reason are mobilized. In many ways, I'm interested in the ways in which I think that we're all infallible and all as the types of creatures we are. I think because of our social relations and because of social pressures, but also the ways in which our brains work, and we are all kind of subject to thinking things that don't necessarily carry weight, and we all do these weird things, but kind of like you say, giving it more considered time and attention, and scientism is offering a framework to begin those questionings, which is quite valuable and interesting, I think.
And that's partly why I focus on the sort of methodological epistemology. So it's less about saying, you know, only the natural world exists and I'm 100% certain of that. It's more about, let's use a method that we think is going to work well. And that doesn't give us any guarantee of perfection at all. You know, we are evolved apes wandering a planet, you know, mostly confused, right? Why should we ever know exactly what's real and what is not real? But it strikes me that using evidence and reason and being aware of our own limitations, we will still always make mistakes and we will never be perfectly right. But if we have provisional credences and probabilistic credences and we act with humility and we're always open-minded and, you know, ready for new evidence, that at least mitigates the risk we'll be wrong, but it doesn't guarantee we'll be right. And it's similar on the ethical side, right? I don't think there is a perfect state to achieve, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't try and, with humility, keep trying to do better. So that's how I'd position it. It's not a black and white thing. It's more a stance that I think gives us our best shot.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you started out the interview saying that you're trying to convince however many billion people might be listening to the show that sentientism is a useful framework, and you know, it sounded almost like sometimes it sounds like it's this universal save everything, but based on our conversation here, you're actually saying that this framework is just a much more nuanced way or it provides a platform and a space with which to ask what you're hoping are more nuanced questions that take into consideration how our relationships impact each other, and each other doesn't stop with humans, it doesn't stop with species.
Yeah, and in a way I am unashamedly universal about it. I think it can have universal application, and I'm nervous about saying that because there are real problems with universal ways of thinking, right? there's a sense of imposition, there's a sense of lack of choice, there's a sense of, you know, power dynamics, and, you know, here's one way of thinking and we must not consider any others. But the reason I'm comfortable talking about universalism in this context is because I think the platform is so basic and so pluralistic that I think it's actually well-grounded. And I don't see a problem in it being universal. So if our commitment is just to using evidence and reason in working out what to believe, that leaves an entire world of possibilities open, that people might use different sets of evidence, they might weight it in different ways, they will have different experiences, they will reason in different ways, they'll have intuition, they'll have intellect, they'll have tools. So there's a dizzying variety of beliefs and credences we might come up with, but at least we're all agreeing to use evidence and reason in a constructive dialogue. And if we turn away from that suggested universal stance, I think we are saying, well, we either need to believe dogmas that aren't grounded in evidence and we're sticking to them for some other reason. And you might be right believing in a dogma, but that would be extremely lucky because dogmas are largely arbitrary. So the chances of it being accurate when you haven't based it in evidence seem vanishingly low. So that doesn't feel attractive to me. And the only other alternatives I'm aware of beyond that are a sort of fideistic decision to believe something purely based on faith in the context that I don't need evidence to support this. I've just chosen to believe this thing, which again, doesn't seem well calibrated to give us the best chance of understanding reality. Or maybe even a sort of extreme skepticism and solipsism where you almost deny reality or ability to understand anything at all, which again, I don't really see as a productive alternative. So that's partly why if you have that portfolio of, you know, what are the possible epistemologies, I'm quite comfortable suggesting a methodological naturalism, you know, using evidence and reason very broadly defined. This isn't just a narrow scientific worldview as a universal stance. And the second part about this sentiocentric moral scope, the alternative to that is excluding beings that can suffer from moral consideration. And I'm very comfortable with that being something we would universally turn away from. I just don't see any reason why you would exclude any sentient being from our moral consideration. So that's partly why I'm nervous about suggesting something could be universal, but I actually think this super basic platform is like a safe universalism that could actually be a platform ultimately anyone could agree to use.
Mm-hmm. So a kind of just that agreement, I think, yes, certainly I would probably agree with you that, yes, we need to, I would maybe carry it like only evidence and reason. And I don't know why. I still always just have that kind of pause. But then I can't quite justify why, which is proving exactly your point. So,
I think there is something important there because it doesn't matter what counts as evidence. So one of the pushbacks I get from many of my guests is that when they challenge this naturalistic stance, some are challenging it because they have a religious belief that they want to hold on to without evidence. And okay, I understand why you're doing that for cultural reasons. And as long as it doesn't, you know, lead you into dangerous ethics, fine, I guess there's no downside, although often it does. So some people are just, you know, I want to hold on to this thing and I don't want to have to use evidence to ground that. But the more common challenge is one where people are not necessarily challenging the use of evidence and reason. They say, well, yeah, that's right. But what I'm nervous about is a sort of narrow scientistic way of thinking. So people are nervous that what I'm saying by evidence and reason is saying, what you need to do is trust the, you know, Western European scientists in the lab coats who've done randomized control trials, and they do the spreadsheet and they tell us what's right and wrong. And that's the end of the story. And that's absolutely not what I'm suggesting. That's partly why I use the terms evidence and reason or methodological naturalism, because I think they're much broader terms than just the scientific method. I think the scientific method is enormously powerful and it's a formalized way of doing this. But I think my personal experiences are evidence. I think different people will have different evidence based on and different ways of reasoning based on their experience and their social context and their upbringing and what's important to them and their identities. There's evidence and reasoning that flows through every culture globally. You know, there are indigenous ways of knowing that are grounded in evidence and reasoning. And I'd argue even that methodological naturalism might even be pre-human, and that in a sense, non-human animals and animals before humans existed were exploring their environments, using their senses, trying to build models of reality so they could survive. And in a sense, that's a proto naturalism. So I think of it in a very, very broad sense, and hopefully that mitigates some of these risks around power and scientism and, you know, and ideas that sort of can feel like they're crushing the joy and the wonder and the awe out of reality, when actually I think this naturalistic way of thinking has enormous awe and wonder and a sense of connectedness too.
To agree with you. I hear astrophysicists talk and I'm like, whoa, they sound like philosophers to me. Yeah. And I hear, you know, you sit outside and you touch the grass, and the more you know, sometimes the more you know, you just see it differently. Other times you just think it looks beautiful. And I think both of those are amazing.
And one of the other challenges is that sometimes people with a scientific worldview can come across as very dogmatic in their own right. So they've done the experiments. Here's the answer. I will not, you know, listen to any challenge. That's not how the scientific method works. And that's not how naturalism works. There's always humility. There's always doubt. There's always openness to new evidence and an honesty to engage with reality. So, you know, just because someone says they have a scientific worldview, if they're being dogmatic, they don't have a scientific worldview.
Fair enough. And I'm being hard. I'm asking you, like, I really like you and what you're doing, and I'm asking really hard questions, but I'm enjoying it a lot. I just want to follow a train of thought here. So with your evidence and reason and compassion, I could imagine a scenario in which, let's say, someone has used, because there you spoke about personal accounts, personal evidence, and of course that comes with, in my view, you know, there are two kind of ends of a spectrum where you know, individual experiences matter, but how you think about individual experiences also matters. So you could imagine a scenario, let's say, for example, where you've got a bunch of dairy farmers that have observed their cows, watched their cows, say that they love their cows, and have observed their cows through and through, and believe that it is compassionate to milk their cows in this way because it gives them a certain amount of relief. And then they say that they are sentientists, right? That they're sentientists because they're using all of these aspects that you're speaking of here. They are using compassion as they would understand it within their agricultural framework. They are using evidence because they've observed numerous cows that have had mastitis and problems with, disease. And they are using reason that if I pump the milk from the cow, this will alleviate some of her pain. If I do X and Y, so I am being compassionate, I'm looking at the welfare of the animal, and I'm doing all of these check boxes. So I am admittedly a sentientist. Now, knowing you, I think that you would probably have a little bit of a reaction to that. So yeah. What do you think?
Well, I think it's interesting because anyone can claim that they have a particular worldview, and I can't disabuse them of that. People will use whatever terms they want to describe their own ways of thinking. But I think once you engage with them and try to understand, okay, well, how are your beliefs here based on evidence and reasoning, and how are you expressing this compassion, it quite quickly becomes clear whether the individual is engaging in good faith and has really come to that stance through an open understanding of the evidence, not just their experience, but all the evidence, and a genuine compassion for the other beings involved, or whether they're just conveniently reverse engineering the terms that we're using and the thinking we're doing to fit around a set of beliefs they've decided in advance they want to hold. And I think you can find similar things with a humanist, right? You can find a humanist who says, well, I'm absolutely humanist, I universal human rights, but then you dig into a stance they might take and you can see whether they're engaging in good faith or not. So I think that would fall apart quite quickly, because although their own personal experience might lead in a particular direction, they also need to be aware of broader evidence of other people's experience and, you know, as far as we can assess it, what it really is like to be a dairy cow and what the other alternatives for that being might be, and to properly empathize with the experience of that being and other ways that they might be able to live their lives, for example, a full lifespan and not being sexually abused and not having their calves taken away and not being milked and so on. So I think at least if they suggest a commitment to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings, you've got a grounding on where you can have a constructive conversation And if it becomes clear that they're not going to shift as the evidence shifts, and they're not going to shift as we draw them into thinking genuinely in a compassionate way about the beings they're engaging with, I think it becomes quite clear that, you know, that stance is probably not one that's held in good faith.
Yeah, I mean, it is tricky. And this is part of the kind of tension with, you know, with maybe like critical animal study scholars versus people that are dealing with welfare of animals. I think I wouldn't position that any of these folks are doing, you know, that they all are very much committed to aiding and assisting animals, but that their view on what constitutes compassion or what would be achievable based on different kinds of reasonings is, and obviously I'm not now equating either of these animal study scholars with farmers, but I think these kinds of tensions are really important and they speak to some of the power with regards to this.
They do, and it's a tricky balance, because on the one hand, I do think that humility and open-mindedness is central to having an intelligent worldview about what's real. And that's also important to our ability to empathize and have compassion with others as well. I mean, that's something we should always be humble about. I will never know exactly what it's like to be you, and I will never know exactly what it's like to be a dairy cow. So again, even that process of compassion is hopefully bounded in us trying to build evidence and try and, with humility, understand. But I do sense in some areas of academia, there's so much willingness to consider different perspectives and so much open-mindedness, they lose any ethical grounding whatsoever, because there's a hesitation to even have a stance. And one of the most egregious examples is in a, I won't cite it because I don't want to draw unnecessary negative attention to it, but it was an article about someone who had engaged in a study where they were working with people in India in animal farming and in a slaughterhouse. And they were talking about how the individuals involved were trying to show some care to the animals as they moved through the process. And one of the concluding statements was something like, maybe in time, even the slaughterhouse will become a place of cross-species compassion.
Right? No.
And that's an extreme example, but this was written by a real academic in the real world. And you've just lost any moral grounding. And you can imagine if someone did that in the human realm, the horror would be clear, right? I mean,
people have done that. And, it's in the human realm, and we've learned.
And they do still today, right? And they do still today. But so that's my nervousness, is if we take our humility and our open-mindedness to the extent where we've sort of given up on knowing anything, or we've given up on having any ethical grounding, and we're just sort of naively exploring this world without judgment, that has many dangers too.
Yeah.
So there is a balancing act here.
I think that's part of the reason why, like in my own writing and in my own kind of conversations, and maybe potentially also why sentientism for me is perhaps too broad, is because you know, I want to write about animals. I feel like I want to make sure that we're talking, and even then, when you're locating specific animals and specific histories and geographies, you know, starting to, as you spoke about earlier, you know, resisting some of the overgeneralizing, because when you do those kind of broad sweeping statements, I think you lose a lot of the everyday lives, the actual everyday joys and tragedies. And I think that, you know, when we talk about nature, there's a lot there in nature, and somehow humans stand next to it, but you lose sight, as you mentioned earlier, of animals, and also of the very distinct ways in which they are impacted. They impact one another, but how we are in relationship with them. And I think that's why I think, you know, certainly for me, I would want more context. I think that there is a desire for kind of context, and I want animals up front. And whether sentient or not, like I'm I think we just deserve to give more attention there as to how they experience and think about the world. And you raised this, so maybe we can come back to, because you and me, we'll talk forever and ever and ever. So you've raised a couple of times now several concerns that guests have raised. And one here is something that I'm expressing. You spoke about kind of the tendency to go really broad and speak about the environment. Another you've mentioned, you just mentioned a moment ago, is that guests are worried about how like evidence and reason is used, and that there's kind of a scientist orientation. They're worried about this kind of Western science being what you're orientated towards. What are some of the other concerns guests have, as well as some of the areas where guests have shown that they're really excited about this concept and how they might find it useful?
So some of the other challenges aren't actually challenging sentientism. They're talking about some of the areas that sentientism is neutral or pluralistic around. So we'll have conversations about, you know, what is the nature of sentience? Is there some sort of panpsychist essence, or is it just the functional operation of the information processing that's going on? There'll be discussions mm-hmm. about where is the boundary, you know, whether it's bivalves or invertebrates or even plants. And again, sentientism doesn't tell us the answer. It just says sort of follow a naturalistic way of working it out and be prudent. And we have lots of conversations about grading of sentience, or whether it's multidimensional, or the crazily diverse array of possible sentient experiences there are across the animal kingdom. And again, mm-hmm. sentientism doesn't flatten those. It says they're amazing, they're wonderful, and they all matter. So some of the conversations aren't really a challenge to sentientism. They're just, okay, what do we do next? Because I totally agree, it's too broad. It's not sufficient by itself. It doesn't mm-hmm. tell us how to resolve, you know, trade-offs. It doesn't tell us whether to use a rights approach or a utilitarian approach or a feminist care ethics approach or a relational approach or a virtue ethics approach. Or there's so much unanswered. It's really just trying to set that baseline. But so I think the challenges to sentientism itself, the core, is one, people who want to have a supernatural way of thinking about the world, and two, people who, there aren't many people who argue for an anthropocentric stance, really, partly because mm-hmm. I don't invite many of them on the podcast, and two, because they're just embarrassed trying to sustain it. But it is really that one about people worrying that a sentient-centric stance is too sharp about excluding the biosphere, the non-sentient biosphere, and the ecosphere too. And that's a really interesting discussion, because from a, you know, I'm quite a strict sentientist, and I ultimately think everything comes back to the valenced experiences of sentient beings. But that mm-hmm. leaves me with a really rich, powerful concern for the ecosystem and the environment and the mm-hmm. biosphere. But the reason I care about those things is because of their instrumental impact on the sentient beings. So that's why mm-hmm. the reason I care about the Earth, but not so much about Mars, is because many quadrillions of sentient beings, they're suffering, they're flourishing, their lives depend on this planet, not so much on all the other hundreds of billions out there. Mm-hmm. So that is a challenge. And that was one of the earliest times the word sentientism was used, actually. It was criticizing people focusing on sentience and saying, look, what about the ecosphere and the biosphere? Whereas I'd say, in a way, it's the only morally justifiable discrimination. Right. Many of the other isms are morally unjustifiable because they exclude people and beings that should be moral patients. Whereas I think sentientism, you know, is the only morally justifiable discrimination in that sense, because it by definition includes any being that has the capacity to value its own experience. And that's the main reason why we should value them too.
Gosh, that's an interesting thread to pull on, and I really want to, because obviously, I mean, I know that plants always come up with this, and I have kind of I want to focus on animals, which makes it a much easier starting point for me to say. And I do think that there are just interesting questions coming up from there, and some, as you've mentioned elsewhere, are done in good faith, and others are done by trolls.
Yeah.
But it does pose interesting questions, you know. The plant conversation, you know, at first, when I first started hearing it, I literally wanted to roll my eyes. I wanted to be like, but you're not listening. Like, there are animals that are dying. And I do think that there are really interesting conversations being had about how plants communicate, the ways in which it's certainly a lot more complex. It's always more complex and fascinating than what we've ever given credit for.
Yeah.
So where will we be 50 years from now? I don't know. And I'm cautious to kind of put up walls, but my concern is
I'm with you on that. And I'd, mm-hmm. there's two ways of talking about the plant thing. One is to say, no, I prefer a biocentric stance, that even if plants are not sentient, they should still get moral consideration. They still matter mm-hmm. in our ethical system. So that's one way. The other is to say, I think plants might be sentient. And sentientism says, well, if there's good naturalistic evidence that plants are sentient, then they should be in our moral circle too.
Yeah.
So sentientism, again, is neutral on that. Now, my understanding of the scientific consensus is that it's pretty strong at the moment, that while there's rich networks of communication and amazing behavior we didn't used to understand, I'm not aware of any scientist that's seriously suggesting they have the capacity for subjective experience, partly because of their anatomy just doesn't seem to have the level of interconnectedness that animals do. So I'm pretty confident that plants aren't sentient, but I'm open-minded, you know, and a good sentientist would be open-minded. If the evidence shifts, then maybe we need to care about, you know, start caring about plants too. I'm skeptical, but.
And of course, we're just creating another kind of weird dichotomy between plants and animals when
it's even a taxonomy.
If you just look at the category of animals is just massive. So the ways in which this would all be thought about, and it just, I guess, like it takes some reasoning and some thinking, some compassion, like you've been saying, some time, I think, to really sit with these ideas.
And the thing I would say is that while we focus on these edge cases, which are really interesting, right? There's big Twitter battles going on at the moment about whether bivalves are sentient or not. And I think those are important things to dig into and use the evidence. And, you know, the edge cases are always really interesting, but they cannot become a distraction to us for the central core obvious case. So, you know, people love talking about whether bivalves are sentient, but we already have overwhelming evidence about the sentience of fish and reptiles and mammals and birds and humans. And so let's not get distracted from the stuff we already agree on and the moral imperative that flows from that.
I think that's a fantastic point. And we do so often, you know, like we do so often lose sight of the fact that there are billions of animals currently being hurt in very obvious and profound ways. And the evidence is quite clear that this is not only bad for them, it's bad for the environment. And yet we continue to buy beef burgers and we continue to do a number of things, which then, as you pointed to at one point in the show, becomes a matter of thinking about why. It's you know, it's not about saying you're a good person or you're a bad person. There's obviously important questions here for thinking about the limits of our epistemology. There's knowing something and then there's behaving differently. And that, again, is an interesting question. And I think one that people are starting to do in really, really fascinating ways. So, Jamie, I'm going to end up keeping you here absolutely forever.
I could talk all afternoon. I'd be quite happy to.
I don't think my guests would be very happy. I'm like, and of course, I brought you on to do a kind of overview of the podcast. We ended up just speaking about sentientism, which I think is a core part of the podcast. Just for some snippets about the podcast before we switch to your quote and short, sharp answers. So let's see, sentientism, how often are episodes coming out for sentientism?
It's probably averages about once a week, sometimes more, sometimes less.
You are just pushing them out there. What kind of guests, if people come and listen to the show, what kind of guests are they going to hear? Academics or what?
The central gravity is quite academic. So philosophers, animal studies people, but I also have lots of activists, I have people from the business world, I have some celebrities, I have some actors. And I also have some interesting public intellectuals who relate to this space. So I've spoken to people like Franz De Waal and Massimo Pellucci, the philosopher Mike Humer. So there are some interesting people, and Henry Mantz, interestingly, who's the features editor of the Financial Times, who's also written a book about animals. So there's some other sort of more public figures that I'm bringing into it too. And also just some, you know, interested lay people like me who feel that this way of thinking resonates.
Yeah, and I know you've had everything from artists on to people talking about stories to people, you know, talking about their own research. So it really is a wide array, and all of you speaking kind of often about the intersections of belief and also of compassion and animals and sentientism. When you're thinking of animal studies scholars or people who are doing research on animals, why do you think listening to this podcast would be useful to them, and or using sentientism in their work would be useful?
I guess the things I'd call out for animal studies scholars are, one is, I think it's really important to emphasize this epistemological naturalism. I think most animal studies scholars sort of assume it anyway, and because they assume it, they don't reference it. But actually, when we think about human culture writ large today, many of the deepest problems, I think, come from broken or flawed epistemologies. So I think it is something we need to refocus on, not just assume, and actually think about epistemology as a key element of animal ethics alongside the ethics. The second thing I think can be quite useful, and many animal ethicists do this already, is I quite like having a pluralistic approach when it comes to ethics. The most important thing for me is we clearly set the moral scope at least to include all sentient beings, and then we can fight over whether it's virtue ethics or feminist care ethics or something else within that. But let's not forget that moral scope. I think setting that moral scope and being clear about that is more important than which ethical system we then choose when we're working out ethical choices within that. And the third thing would be remind ourselves what moral consideration and compassion actually mean at the basic level. Because I struggle to understand, and there are people, even academics in the animal studies space, who will talk about compassion and will talk about moral consideration, but will still find some way in their personal lives and even in their work to justify what I see of as the needless harming and killing of sentient beings. And I just don't understand how those things are consistent. I think those people, brilliant as they are still sort of trapped, and the brains are shifted by the powerful social norms we most of us grow up in that tell us it's completely normal to do these things. So, you know, draw that baseline, be very clear about, if someone said to me, look, I care about you, I have compassion for you, I have moral consideration for you, but now I'm going to needlessly harm and kill you for trivial reasons, I would question whether their statement of compassion was genuine. Clearly it isn't, right? It doesn't fit with the definition. So that would be the third thing, was let's remind ourselves what, you know, the minimal level of moral consideration or compassion means. And Milan Angles has done some great work on that academically. I think his paper about mere considerability makes that point really clear. You know, fine, fight over the details, fight over the trolley problems, fight over the really difficult moral trade-offs. But surely this baseline is that however we grant moral consideration, it must exclude the needless harming and killing.
Mm-hmm.
So those would probably be the three things I'd push on.
That's great. And I'm going to stop there. I have many things I want to ask you. I'm going to stop there and say, I know you've got a quote for us. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the quote and then let us hear it?
This is a little strange because it's a quote from an article I haven't written yet.
But so we've just got to have faith that you're writing this article, Jim?
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure it even counts as a quote here. So yeah, this is getting very wobbly. But let me give it a go. And it will. I'm hoping it will tie together some of the stuff we've talked about here.
All right.
So it strikes me that all human-caused problems come down either to a failure of compassion or a failure of epistemology. Either we don't care, or we've just got something wrong, or often both. Those failures can be within individual minds, in social norms, or in institutional policies. So people and groups with accurate beliefs can still do terrible harms if they exclude others from their compassion. And compassionate people or groups can do terrible harms if they're wrong about reality. There's no perfect fix to these problems, but maybe we could at least agree a starting point, a minimal pluralistic baseline worldview with just two tenets. First, that the best way to understand reality is to engage honestly with it. Second, that the best safeguard against needlessly causing suffering is to include all those who are capable of experiencing suffering in our moral scope. Neither of these tenets is sufficient by itself. We need both. In short, a commitment to evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings.
That did sum up everything that you've been saying. Thank you so much, Jamie. Yeah, it's been really interesting talking to you and learning a bit about the show, as well as how you've came to, you know, sentientism as an important concept. And if anyone's interested in learning more about sentientism, Jamie's been on tons of like other shows as well. I'll put some of them in the show notes. He's also runs his own podcast, which we've been talking about here, Sentientism, and his website, as well as there's Facebook pages. There's lots to kind of learn and follow through and think about. So if this is something that you think is interesting for your own work, or you're just keen on learning more, definitely go follow some of the links to find out more about Jamie's work. Jamie, what are you currently working on now?
It is persuading. I think we've persuaded about 100 million people to be sentientists so far. Although, to be fair, most of those haven't.
I thought you were saying my show. That's why I was laughing.
No. I think we're going to do another billion after this. To be fair, most of those 100 million people have probably never heard of the word sentientism, but they just happen to have this sort of worldview already. But I think we've got about 100 million locked in. So we've got 7.8 billion left to go. So I think, yeah, this podcast will help us tip over the edge. And of course, we don't need to persuade everybody. We just need to persuade enough to start things tipping. Mm-hmm. So in short, it's more of the same at the moment. I want the communities to grow, more fascinating interviews on the YouTube and the podcast. It was wonderful to have you as a guest. I'm going to try and do more writing and more thinking about the content. And one of the things that we are building out is some much clearer descriptions on the sentientism.info website of what the implications of this worldview might be. Because mm-hmm. it's so basic and pluralistic, it runs through every field of human and non-human endeavor. So we've already done thinking about what would a Universal Declaration of Sentient Rights look like if we upgraded the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Oh, we've done some work around what if you took the Sustainable Development Goals and rewrote them as sentientist development goals, what might those look like? What would a sentientist economics look like? Or following Alistair Cochrane, what would a sentientist politics look like? What would sentientist agriculture look like? So again, we're building out those sections of the website to try and, you know, suggest policy implications, personal decision implications, mm-hmm. institutional implications of this worldview, many of which tie up quite neatly with existing programs and organizations mm-hmm. and movements, but some of them do not. So, yeah, that's really, another thing to watch out for.
Really useful and helpful. You know, when you're dealing with such a broad thing, I think one of the things that makes it scary is because it is so broad and people. Yeah. So I think that really does help to kind of latch and see the potential, the productive potential of this concept and the people who are working on it. So I'm looking forward to seeing some of that stuff and what you're working on. Could you just give us the URL for the website?
Yes, sentientism.info. And the word is a bit clunky, but if you just start with sentient and add ism on the end, you'll be there.
Sentientism.
Sentientism, yeah. So that's sentientism.info and @sentientism on Twitter.
@sentientism on Twitter. Okay, fantastic. I'll make sure that that's in the show notes too. Thank you so much for your time and for your thoughts and for all the energy you put into this. It's been really great. And for being on my first podcast review.
Thank you so much. It's an honor. It was great being your guest, and it was brilliant having you as a guest.
A huge thank you to Jamie for being a fantastic guest, for dealing with all of my challenges in a really, I think, graceful way. Thank you to Animals and Philosophy, Politics, Law and Ethics, Apple for sponsoring this podcast, to Jeremy John for the logo and Gordon Clark for the music. Thank you, listeners, for listening. And to those of you who leave reviews, thank you so much. I really do appreciate it. And stay tuned. There's more coming. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Hurtenfelder.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IROARPOD.com.